The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's that time of week again. Once again, it's time for what has become, for many of you, your favorite Intelligent Medicine feature, which is Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is Hoffman Center nutritionist. We work together on a daily basis, seeing patients, and she is a registered dietitian, and she has earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition. So without further ado, here's Layla. How you doing?
All right, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Great. So we find ourselves already in the beginning of August. That's incredible.
I can't believe it.
Where has the summer gone?
I'm not ready.
Especially after that winter. I think we should get extra month credit for the winter that we went through. Maybe we could just declare.
Who do we check that with? Who do we clear that with?
I think in summer. I think in traditional Jewish religion, once in a while, instead of a leap. Leap year where they add a day, they add a month.
Oh,
so
great.
maybe we can go back to the ancient Hebrew tradition and add a month so we can
Let's extend our summer. Let's do it.
Okay. Absolutely. So anyway, it's been a busy week, lots of health news, and among the stories that we talked about, we talked last week about marijuana because the New York Times came out with an editorial resoundingly in favor of legalization of marijuana. So I recorded a podcast in my clinical focus on the subject of marijuana pro and con in terms of the potential harms of marijuana, which are very real indeed. I think that the New York Times in their editorial had a very dismissive and cavalier attitude towards the potential for addiction, the potential for mental problems that pot can cause, developmental problems if used too early in adolescence, and the health problem. You're burning weed and inhaling it is not necessarily healthy for you. So also, I read a fascinating article in the New England Journal of Medicine about, it was entitled Big Marijuana May Learn from Big Tobacco. And what they're saying here is that, we've regulated the hell out of the tobacco industry because it was actually kind of a novelty, the idea of pre-rolled cigarettes that you could buy in a package. Everybody used to take their own tobacco, dry the leaves, roll it in, and then they came out with this industrialization of tobacco, and they came up with better and better ways to deliver the addictive nicotine. And, if there's legalization of marijuana, you'll be able to walk into a 7-Eleven and buy a package of marijuana cigarettes, and they'll be perfectly rolled, symmetrical, and they may be even higher in their intoxicating potential. Can you imagine like social media and advertisements, like be cool, smoke marijuana, it's a lifestyle thing. And of course, they're going to make it so that only 21 years and above can purchase marijuana. Mm-hmm. But what happens with cigarettes? I mean, I wish I had a book for every kid under the age of legal smoking who smokes cigarettes. They just get a hold of them. They're in the environment and they're out there. So, I'm not a big fan. But on the other hand, there are some potential applications, healthy applications of marijuana. So check out our podcast and check out our article at drhoffman.com if you're concerned about the debate. I think I provide a little bit of a useful counterpoint to the New York Times legalization editorial. And I know that they extended their coverage of that issue with a little bit of pro and con and some more detailed reporting, but I just think it's irresponsible for their editorial board to call for legalization. I think it's wrong. Mm.
Yeah. All right, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, so indeed. What's on the agenda for today? By the way, for listeners who are desirous of posing your questions to Layla and yours truly, you can email your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and if appropriate, we will select your question, we'll read it on the air, and we'll answer it, as we're about to do with our next question.
Okay. Our first question, we've got an email from Emerald in Virginia. What are Dr. Gonzalez's thoughts on a low-carb diet and Alzheimer's? Dr. Perlmutter believes there's a strong correlation between carb consumption and shrinkage of the memory center of the brain. Dr. Gonzalez's comments on the ineffectiveness of a low-carb diet as a cancer therapy were convincing. I saw that video. You did too, Dr. Hoffman, did you?
Mm-hmm.
It is very convincing.
Well, I did interview Dr. Gonzalez for one of our podcasts recently, so you go back a couple of weeks, and we talked to him. And the reason I spoke to him is because he's a real expert at dealing with cancer using various diets. And I know he uses a full spectrum of diets. He's not a one-note Charlie. He's not
That's true.
Paleo guy, and he's not a vegan guy. And he says he has like 8 or 9 different diets on the spectrum from, you know, juicing, raw foods, vegetarian, mm-hmm. to really high animal protein and fat. And, you know, his take on the carbohydrate restriction for cancer is that it can work in some cases, but that it's by no means a universal way of eliminating cancer. So, you know, I didn't talk to him about his feelings about the Perlmutter diet, the very low-carb diet, the ketogenic diet for brain disorders, for Alzheimer's. But I have a feeling that he would probably reply in a similar vein. He would say there's no one-size-fits-all. And while there is evidence that carbohydrates and elevated hemoglobin A1C and, you know, poorly controlled blood sugar damage the brain, that's not the rationale for everybody to abandon carbohydrates and, you know, make their keto sticks turn purple every time they, you know, take a pee.
Right, right. And, you know, the keto sticks don't turn purple for everybody.
No.
At least 40% of the population, even though they're in ketosis, the keto sticks are not a great measure for them.
Right.
But,
and you speak from experience because you worked with patients at the Atkins Center way back when.
Yeah, but what Dr. Perlmutter is saying, really, if Alzheimer's is classified as diabetes of the brain or insulin resistance of the brain, it makes logical sense that being in ketosis would only be helpful. But you also have to ask the question, you know, how early on, of course, you're going to get a much better outcome with a ketogenic diet, I believe. But in the much, much later stages, I wonder about that.
Yeah, it may not have
how
certain...
How much damage has been done, how much of that can actually be reversed, you know, how much can the amyloid plaque be cleared after a certain, you know, sometimes the brain is just overwhelmed. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, there's also some evidence that coconut oil, which is a source of ketones, mm-hmm. Can be a useful adjunct to the treatment of Alzheimer's. And I think that that's a principle that we still need to follow. A patient should not have wild swings of blood sugar. That we want to identify which patients are insulin resistant with a glucose tolerance test, measure their insulin, not just their glucose.
Yeah.
Very closely monitor the hemoglobin A1C because the glycosylation of hemoglobin, which is the mm-hmm. basis of that test, is actually a proxy for damage to proteins throughout the body, not just in the red blood cell. And so when you have a high hemoglobin A1C, it means you're literally frying your proteins and damaging them throughout your body, heart, brain, nerves, every organ of your body, your skin, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is a very, very interesting topic. I'm sure we're going to learn much, much more as time goes on.
They're talking more and more about this because try as they might, and I pointed this out in an article I wrote a couple of weeks ago, they are just not coming up with the magic bullet for Alzheimer's disease. They're spending billions of dollars to find the pharmaceutical industry. And they're actually getting a little gun shy because they've invested a lot of money and they've come up to a lot of dead ends. Mm. And, of course, an effective Alzheimer's drug would be a blockbuster medication. But they're being more cautious, and they're saying, you know, these drugs are not yet ready for prime time. They're minimal effectiveness. And so as a national policy, we shouldn't wait for the magic pill. We should be working on preventive measures. And that's what we emphasize in our writings and in our work with patients, trying to keep their brain from being damaged by free radicals, using useful nutraceuticals like resveratrol and curcumin and DHA and, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll be doing a clinical focus on Alzheimer's?
I already wrote an article on it.
You've already got an article on it. Terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrific. Okay. So, next question. This comes from Edward. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. I take a mixture of vitamins separately, and I just wanted to know if there's any danger in mixing these vitamins. They are vitamin A, vitamin E, Bs, B12, D3, C, selenium, green stuff, liquid mushroom, and green stuff, garlic. Well,
well, you know, see, this actually, I mean, it sounds a little bit like, frankly, this is a little bit like a question of, do you approve of my supplement program?
Yeah.
That's a little bit what it sounds like. And, I, you know, this is a kind of question that we really can't answer for any single patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could say, oh, my goodness, you're taking something that's been proven to be a real waste of time or bogus or toxic. So we'll just no way to know how should you take this. On the other hand, we cannot assess the appropriateness mm-hmm. of these supplements for this individual. But I think that's, you know, maybe he's trying to elicit that from us in a maybe slightly underhanded way. But, you know, as to whether they can mix together, will smoke come out of his ears if he takes them all simultaneously? I doubt that too.
I would question the sources and, you know, a little more detail on what you mean by green stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of green stuff and so forth. So, yeah, a consult would be in order, I think.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
But, yeah, as far as, you know, these ingredients, he ran them by us and they seem to be safe. And, well, let's speak a little bit about intercompatibility of supplements. Because mostly, I think the ingredients in supplements are fairly compatible. Are there any? Can you think of any egregious examples where you really wouldn't want to take certain things simultaneously or together?
As far as micronutrients, not necessarily. Well, strontium and calcium.
I think that's an example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where the calcium, take those separately.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the manufacturers, so they probably have stopped doing this now, but they used to come up with a super pill for osteoporosis that they threw everything in, magnesium and calcium and vitamin D and some strontium, not usually enough.
I've seen those, yes.
Yeah, and what happens is the calcium and the strontium may antagonize one another. And we don't even know that much about it. Some people are very fearful about eating any calcium for hours away from their strontium. We just suggest that people don't take a calcium pill in close proximity to their strontium. That would be about 2 or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to take your calcium taken in the morning, take your strontium usually at bedtime. And other things that are, you know, I don't know, I guess there are potentially some incompatible things. It's more the incompatibility of certain drugs with certain supplements.
Absolutely.
That maybe has us worried. So,
right.
You know, if you're
one
taking
one big one that jumps out is St. John's wort.
Yes,
which we rarely prescribe anyway because it interacts with so many things.
So many drugs, yeah. But
yeah.
It speeds up the metabolism of many drugs. I believe that's how it works.
Okay.
So that they, in effect, are less effective.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want that. If somebody's taking medication that they really need, St. John's wort may speed the metabolism of the drug. Milk thistle does this to some extent. So sometimes you go to a health food store and you say, gee, I'm on all these medications. Can I do something to protect my liver? And the helpful clerk behind the counter says, oh, take this, and puts milk thistle down on the counter. And milk thistle indeed protects the liver, but it does so by reducing the effectiveness of certain medications, you know, sort of washing them out more quickly. And therefore, I can't list all the medications. You have to look at a table to show the potential interactions to see if there's a compatibility. Now then, there's helpful synergy. So while, for example, with Coumadin, sometimes doctors say don't take fish oil because fish oil is also a blood thinner, so you don't want to thin your blood while you're already taking a blood thinner. But actually, studies show that if you add a little bit of fish oil to Coumadin, it actually reduces the incidence of pathological bleeding, you know, excess bruising or nosebleeds.
Interesting.
Or if you cut yourself.
You would think that would be contraindicated, yeah.
You would think so, but the studies actually reveal that it's permissible to have some. On the other hand, vitamin K blunts the effect of Coumadin, so you don't want to take too much vitamin K, although mm-hmm. Some studies suggest you can take moderate amounts of vitamin K, which is an important vitamin.
A pet peeve of mine, Dr. Hoffman, is when a patient comes in who's already on Coumadin and they were told erroneously to avoid any and all green
vegetables. Green vegetables, I know. That's nuts.
And that just drives me absolutely crazy. And I show them, I outline to them that you can have this many servings of these particular vegetables and more of others and less of these others still.
Yeah.
So I think it's terrible advice to tell somebody just off the cuff because you're on this medication.
These are the very patients, they're on Coumadin, they probably have atrial fibrillation or some form of clotting problem, mm-hmm. blood clots to their lungs. Many of these patients are elderly. So if you don't eat any healthy fruits or vegetables, you don't have any green tea, which is a healthful substance that contains vitamin K, then you will fall prey to cancer. You may fall prey to cardiovascular disease, because we know that a little bit of vitamin K is necessary for prevention of cardiovascular disease, particularly vitamin K2. And so, that's bad advice all around.
Yeah.
So
other things that potentiate within the micronutrients themselves, iron, the absorption of iron is enhanced by having vitamin C.
Correct.
So things of that nature. Vitamin C and vitamin E are also somewhat recycled by, I think it's CoQ10?
Alpha-lipoic acid, I think.
Or alpha-lipoic acid. No, alpha-lipoic
they may
acid.
All play a role, but I think alpha-lipoic acid is considered the master antioxidant. Yeah.
Okay. Great. All right. So, all right, do we have time for another?
Indeed.
Great. This comes from Jill in Seattle, and this is a question regarding flaxseed. I have found conflicting information regarding how to consume flaxseed. A Harvard University site and also Dr. Oz says that flaxseed must be ground to properly digest the seeds and reap the benefits. However, a sprouting site claims that it is most nutritious and best taken after sprouting for a minimum of 4 hours. Could they both be correct? I love sprouting them overnight before eating them in the morning, but I want to make sure I'm getting the benefits. I think you could go both ways on this.
I think so, too. And I think that here's a rare occasion where Harvard and Dr. Oz are on the same page and are actually both right, I think, because flaxseed, whole flaxseed the seeds are very small. You may swallow them whole and they may not be properly digested. So you need to break them open to allow their contents to be released. And I really like flax seeds because they're a source of flax lignans.
Yes.
It's spelled lignans. And these lignans are wonderful compounds. They seem to both reduce cardiovascular disease and they may reduce the incidence of breast cancer and prostate cancer. And they may also have an impact on colon cancer risk. So they're wonderful plant compounds. And you can't get the benefits from flaxseed oil that you get from flaxseed. And plus, flaxseed is a wonderful fiber, so it has a bit of a laxative effect, bulking effect. It's a prebiotic. It promotes the growth of healthy bacteria in your intestinal tract. And so when it comes to sprouting, sprouting does change the nutritional profile of things like beans, for example, somewhat. But I don't think it would be harmful to sprout your flax seed. I'm not sure how it precisely changes the nutrient composition, whether it reduces the lignans or whether it enhances the level of other helpful nutrients, because the green sprout may impart additional helpful nutrition.
Well, apparently, according to Jill, they taste good. So
there you go.
That's also a good thing, too.
That's also a good thing.
And we often recommend, even for bowel regularity, taking 2 to 4 tablespoons of flax meal.
Yeah.
Is also good. So
one caveat on that is to try to, if you're going to get flax meal, try to get it really fresh, not rancid, because if it sits around, once you open the seed, it becomes rancid very quickly. So when I get flaxseed, I sometimes get fresh whole flaxseed and I grind it in a coffee grinder.
In a coffee mill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I'll use as much as I need, but I'll store it, even the whole seeds, in the freezer because keep longer that way, because they'll get rancid very quickly otherwise, and then you'll lose the nutritional value, and the taste gets funky too. I mean, a lot of people
that's the rancidity.
I think a lot of people need a course in how to detect rancidity of oils, because people just use them and they don't have a nose for it, and the oils become much less valuable, and oil laden seeds like that are oxidized and they're just damaged.
Yeah, the same as with nuts. If you bring home roasted nuts, they don't last for a year on the kitchen counter.
Oh, I I can't tell you how many times I've gone with great hope and expectancy to get fresh walnuts, mm-hmm. roasted almonds, roasted cashews, although they're a little less susceptible to rancidity, and they just tasted awful. I've had to throw away the whole bag. I can't. And then what happens is I lose faith in the store completely, and then I don't shop there.
You know, I have
once
solution.
Once burned, I just don't. What? Taste them?
Get them in the shell. Get them in the shell. Get a nutcracker. It's fun to fight for them. There's nothing like a fresh walnut right out of the shell. Honest to God, it's just wonderful.
Well, you know, I agree. It's just that I'm a little impatient for that. And, you know, it's like, that's very paleo because it's like work. It's like hunting for your food. You have to expend calories so that you get your nutrition.
Well, it's like pistachio nuts. They're fun to fight for, too. You don't need a nutcracker for that, but yeah. They're just much fresher coming right out of the shell.
Right.
And then we eat the proper amount of them, and we don't go overboard by eating half the bag, which becomes a bazillion calories and so forth.
Yeah, it's like using chopsticks.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it slows your eating, because especially if you're clumsy. Okay. So, yeah, we have time for one additional question, if it's short, before we break for part two. So,
okay, here's one. This comes from Dennis, who has a dear friend who was vacationing in Colorado when she learned she had been bitten close to the eye by a black widow spider. Long story short, she went to the ER. She was prescribed antibiotics in case of infection, told to take NSAIDs. And Dennis's question is, in the case of neurotoxic venomous spider bites, do calcium deglucarate, NAC, or glutathione work? Well, not acutely.
And, you know, this reminds me a little bit of a phone call that I once got from a guy in from one of our radio stations near El Paso, Texas. And I thought, wow, this is great. We're getting a call from Texas. Let's put this guy on. And it was like, hey, Dr. Hoffman, what do you do for rattlesnake bites?
Oh, boy.
I was like, whoa, you know, that's not, yeah. I mean, I get a lot of calls from New Jersey and Connecticut and, you know, the Bronx, Brooklyn. And that was definitely a different kind of call. So black widow spider bites, you know, I'm not sure that there is a nutritional solution. However, I think that N-acetylcysteine might be a plausible thing because it generates glutathione. And glutathione is a great detoxifier and potentially it might help. But I know of no, you know, if you're bitten by a venomous snake or insect, you know, I'm not sure that nutritional support is the answer, or if it's going to make a big difference, frankly.
I agree. A trip to the ER is in order.
Black widow spider. Oh, my
Black widow spider, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, Dr. Hoffman, about 10 years ago, my husband was bit by a brown recluse.
Yeah, he does a lot of carpentry and construction work. Yeah.
Well, he was out there in the woods, was bitten, and after a couple of days when he saw it wasn't getting better and somebody saw that it was getting worse, said, you know, dude, you need to go to the ER, and he did. He came very close to losing his leg.
Yeah. You know, what ends up happening is the danger is not like a rattlesnake bite where, you know, the poison can reach your heart and can have cardiovascular effects or certain other types of stings or bites. The problem is the poison actually creates what's called necrosis, tissue death. So initially, it may seem like, oh, that's not so bad. But then that you literally can get a crater where the bite was because or an ulceration. And that just can really fester and become a very severe problem. So I'm glad he's still got his arms and legs.
Oh, yeah. He took pictures of it and everything.
Yeah. he's intact. He's, he's 100%. Okay. Good. All right. So, yeah, it's a guy thing. It's like, oh, yeah, I just got bitten by a brown recluse spider.
I'll just
put some rubbing alcohol on it. You know,
you're right.
Yeah. Put my leg up. You know, it's all right. You know, these guys, they just don't take care of themselves. This is before you met him, right?
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Or you're not responsible.
No.
Okay. Let's take a break. And when we return, we'll continue with questions. This is our weekly Q&A with Layla. And we'll continue and give us a tease to what we're going to talk about in part two.
Oh, about adrenal health.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A big question on adrenal health.
Good. So, subject that I covered recently in a podcast.
In a Clinical Focus, yes.
In a Clinical Focus podcast. Mm-hmm. You can go to the archives and find it. Meanwhile, stay tuned for part two of this week's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.